You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Have you ever wondered if your brain is normal as brains go? Maybe you're usually one of the last people to finish a test, or you get stressed out about going to parties, or insert your personal quirk here. Our next guest says thinking about our brains as normal or not normal is really oversimplifying things. She's studied neuroscience for years and says every brain is different and constantly being shaped by its own specific environment. She's also got some tools to help us better understand how our own brains work. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about how brains work? What makes one person's different from another? What the different pieces of our brains do? And are there kind of tasks that you think you're really good at or others that you struggle with that set you apart from other people? You wonder why that is? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Chantel Pratt is a psychologist and neuroscientist at the University of Washington. Her new book out today is The Neuroscience of You, How Every Brain is Different and How to Understand Yours. Chantel, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me here. I'm really looking forward to learning with your listeners and to talking to you.
All right. Now, I know one way I think about my brain is wrong. And let's get this out of the way right out front. You know, I assume that there's this reality out there and my brain is this, you know, camera and listening device. And it's just showing me what's really out there. In fact, it's a little more complicated, right? Our brain is this interpretive storyteller. You write about this in your book.
Yeah, that's correct. And, you know, I like to start out with a really safe example, which was the dress that took the internet by storm because people couldn't agree about whether it was blue or black and white or white and gold. And I think the reason that that captivated so many people is that the storytelling of your brain is so convincing, right?
Yeah, definitely. And so what is going on? Let's run with that example. Why might I see a dress as one color and somebody else see it as another, but it's the same image?
Right. So most of us learned at some point in our lives that color, something as elementary as color, has a straightforward mapping to physical energy in the world, right? You learned at some point that, you know, slower waves are red, yellow, red, orange end of the rainbow, and the faster light waves are at the blue, indigo end of the rainbow, and that you have these cones in the back of your eye that absorb light at different wavelengths and send signals to your brain telling you what color you see. It feels very one-to-one mapping in terms of the physical energy in the world and the things that you see. But if it were like that, then we would all see things changing color all the time as the property of the light around us changed. So a green apple would turn red in the sunset and blue in a shadow. Instead, our brains learn over time that the light bouncing off things is more likely to change than the color of an object itself. So something as elementary as color vision is still really inferential in your brain. Your brain takes a sample of all the context around an object and decides based on its relative light waves that are bouncing off of that thing, what color it is. And when people see the dress, well, let me just say that the thing that makes the dress ambiguous and interesting is that there isn't a lot of context in it. It's just a picture of kind of the torso of some person. And so there, your brain guesses, where's the light? What's going on around this thing? It doesn't have a lot of context. And people who see the dress as white and gold, their brains have automatically and instantly assumed that there's light coming from behind the dress and that it's in a shadow. So they subtract the blue and black hues that actually make up the dress. They subtract it right out of the picture, and the person perceives white and gold.
And that's just Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh, I was just going to say we know a little bit. Some interesting experiments have given us some suggestions about why I might make a different assumption than you about the lighting. And for instance, a small percentage of what makes people see one thing or the other relates to how much time you spend in natural versus overhead lighting. And so people who are larks or wake up early in the morning and are more likely to spend time in naturally lit environments are more likely to see the dress as white and gold, are more likely to think it's in a shadow. And people who are night owls and so spend more time awake after dark are more likely to see the dress as blue and black, to assume the lighting is coming from straight overhead. This is just a little example of how our thousands and thousands of experiences with light shape the way our brain interprets the world around us.
And you write that there's a lot of research and writing about brains in general, on average. And you make the case that each of our brains is really unique. And there are zillions of examples like the dress of how there's variation from me to you to whoever.
Right. Yes. And I think that, you know, the idea of normal as I think that many of us think that when we say something is normal, especially when it comes to a brain function, we're pointing to a single ideal, like a template. But in fact, we can't even define normal unless we understand the ways that people vary. And so normal in reality is this multidimensional space. There are lots of different axes on which brains are different. And in this space, there's a lot of room for brains to work differently and not be better or worse suited for functioning, just different.
Talking to Chantal Pratt about her new book. It's called The Neuroscience of You, How Every Brain is Different and How to Understand Yours. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions about our brains and how they may differ from one person to another and how we read, interpret the world around us. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring out a caller. Jeff is with us in Superior. Jeff, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. I want to share that, you know, years ago in my 20s, I volunteered in a drug and alcohol treatment center. And the professionals there loved my insights and the intuition that I wrote in the treatment papers and notes. And we had, during a treatment meeting, they said, Jeff, what's your secret for being such a good listener? And I used the phrase that I sit 3 feet behind my head. So I'm able to be detached, but I'm engaged. And I don't let my emotions lead me to my next thought. And I was able to observe and be very productive in terms of helping the clients in their recovery. I enjoyed it.
Jeff, thanks for that call and for sharing that story. And Chantal, two things there. Something's making Jeff a good listener, but he also talked about kind of being aware of his own brain and taking a position a few feet behind it in a way to help make him a good listener. What does that make you think about?
I think that is fascinating, and how wonderful that your brain landed on that strategy for you. Because in fact, in the book, I talk about one of the things that gets in the way of us understanding, especially people who work differently from us, is that our most natural way of connecting with others is to mirror them or to simulate using what has been called mirror neurons, the way your brain, the state your brain would be in if you were behaving this way. This is our instinct. This is what babies do when they observe the actions of others. Their brains say, oh, I see a hand moving. This is the motor program that I would need to do to move that hand. And it kind of puts you in an internal state that is similar to, ideally, it's similar to the person you're observing. Through this, when things go well, you experience empathy. And like, for instance, if you see someone in pain and you feel pain, that's what's going on. But social neuroscientists are finding out more and more that we tend to hang out with people whose brains work just like ours do. So this kind of mirroring works really well when we have people with lots of shared experiences and similar brains that work similar ways. So what the caller's, you know, his brain seemed to be doing was, let me take a step out of my perspective and just observe this person for what they are and try and understand that person sort of separate from this brain behind the eyes. And I think that's brilliant. I mean, what I'm hoping to do is to give people some concrete examples about these different ways that people work so they can have a tool belt with which to draw upon if somebody is not behaving the way you think you would behave if you were in that situation.
Thanks for that call, Jeff, at 800-642-1234. We're talking to neuroscientist Chantal Pratt from the University of Washington. Her new book is out today. It's called The Neuroscience of You, How Every Brain is Different and How to Understand Yours. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What have you noticed about the way your own brain works? Do you feel like in some key way your brain works differently than the people around you? What is that? Why is it, do you think? Or do you have a question about why that might be? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about the new book, The Neuroscience of You, How Every Brain is Different and How to Understand Yours. Chantel Pratt with the University of Washington stays with us, a neuroscientist and psychologist. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, questions, maybe your observations about how your own brain works. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Lori is with us in Stevens Point. Lori, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
Well, my question is, as we go through life, does your thought process and such as change based on experiences of like trauma, or if you're heavy being an empath, or just how do those experiences alter how your brain functions?
Lori, thanks. A great question, Chantel. What do you think?
Well, there's a lot in there. I mean, I think you can probably intuit if you think about how your brain worked when you were a teenager, or even how your brain works in the morning and the evening, that it does change. It changes with experience. It changes with the sort of neurochemical weather that changes across the day and depending on what you eat. Things like trauma, or, you know, experiencing empathy, sort of connecting with others and their emotions, have different effects on different brains. And it really depends on what was already happening. What is the chemical and connectivity, the sort of the weather is the best. I don't know why that metaphor popped into my head, but what was already going on when those things happen? So do our brains change with experience? Absolutely. My brain has already changed in the conversations that we're having. The question is, how noticeable will that be, or how impactful will that be? And that really depends on the experience. Now, one thing I can tell you is that part of that experience is the original event. And another part of that experience is your re-experiencing of that event. So if you rehearse the event, or if you tell yourself a story about the event, you know, like, I might be behaving this way because of X, those things can re-affect your brain. In fact, not only can they do. So every time you think about an event, the emotions that you're experiencing, the sort of neural weather, so to speak, they get laid down in the memory trace in the way that shapes your brain.
Thanks a lot for that call, Lori, at 800-642-1234. Tom joins us now in Cornell. Tom, hi.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. What do you want to tell us about, Tom?
Well, you know, I've got my son. He was actually born in the Philippines. He's only been in America. He was only in America for 8 months in an English-speaking community. But at less than 20 months old, he actually taught himself how to read. He could barely speak English at this point, but was already reading words like book, said, you know, father, mother, stuff like that. Now he's 2.5 now, and he's able to sound out words like stegosaurus, you know,
wow,
like just dictionary, you know, crazy big words that a 2.5-year-old shouldn't know. so how does, and he's good at everything. He's doing addition already, math, subtraction, puzzles. But
Tom,
yeah,
thanks a lot for sharing that with us. I remember in my early days of parenting, Chantel, I could freak myself out like, oh, my kid isn't at this stage now, or maybe they're ahead here, but behind there. Those things are going to happen at different paces for different kids, partly because I guess their brains are different.
Mm-hmm. And partly because their experiences are different. So I would say give yourself some credit, Tom, because you can't actually learn to read without some input. You can leave a baby, and this I can, you know, put my hand to the flame for. You can leave a baby in a, you know, playpen full of newspaper their whole entire life, and unless somebody points to things and pronounces them, they're never going to pick it up. But I think that the really interesting thing about reading is that it's a relatively new skill that our brains have developed. Unlike spoken language, which kids pick up in the water, so to speak, right? Like almost every active brain will learn a language if it's exposed to it. Reading is something that needs thousands of hours of practice. So I would say it's a combination of, yes, the way your child's brain is built and the inputs that they've had that also probably allow them to love this game. You know, you said Stegosaurus, this is so cool. And when they feel like rewarded from the adults around them, and when they're good at something, you get this kind of a Matthew effect where the rich get richer. And I think we just need to be aware of this as parents too. If we are subconsciously worrying about our kids being delayed, and are we saying those kind of things around them, and are we treating them differently? Because the reverse can also happen. If you think, oh, they're struggling, or you make it not fun, you have a concerned face, you can have the opposite effect as well.
Thanks a lot for that call, Tom, at 800-642-1234. Talking to neuroscientist Chantel Pratt about her new book, The Neuroscience of You. Back to your calls now with Pat in Green Bay. Pat, what's on your mind?
I just got a real quick question. How does it come about that some of us end up with learning disabilities? There's just certain things that I can memorize, but there are other things I love, but I can't wrap my head around it. Being able to remember certain things.
Pat, thanks for the call, Chantel. Pat, definitely not alone.
Yes, that's right. And I think that, you know, what the research that I and others have been doing, I think one really important message is that some of the things that we consider a disability, and I'm doing air quotes here, that you can't see, are people who struggle in traditional learning environments. And I think that when you're saying like some things I can learn and other things I can't, I would just ask you to hold in mind that your brain has been evolving, not your individual brain has been evolving through your lifespan, but human brains have been evolving for a very, very long time. And the kinds of things that we ask them to do right now are not perfectly characteristic of the kinds of things that our ancestors asked their brains to do. And unfortunately, I think that our education system is built on the one-size-fits-all approach to neuroscience and assumes it sort of caters to the way that the majority of people learn or the way that we think people should learn. And my hope is that if we understand the spaces of brain differences, and we understand what is it that makes learning some things easier for you than others? What is the information processing characteristic of that particular task that makes it easy for you? How can we create, instead of saying this brain is disabled or this brain has a problem learning here, can we use this information to create optimal learning environments for each brain?
Pat, thanks a lot for that call. Chantel, a big point of your book is encouraging us to use our brains to think about our brains, which is, I don't know, kind of a paradoxical or something in that neighborhood. But how can we get started on that path? What kind of things can we do to look at the way, think about the way we think, and then what do we do with it?
So it was really cute. My daughter, who's 27, made a post on social media yesterday, and it said, "Can you even know yourself if you don't know how your brain works?" And I would argue no. So mostly because, you know, we talked about the dress and how shocking it was. I just think that we have an artificially inflated sense of confidence most of the time about the way we understand the world. You know, we have, like you said, the reality that our brain creates is so convincing that we don't understand all of the interpretation that goes into that. So if you want to really understand yourself and understand how your brain might be perceiving the same environment differently from someone else, I'd encourage you to read the book or go to my website, Chantel Pratt, ChantelPratt.com. On the research tab, you can play some games that will give you feedback instantly about some of the different ways that brains work and even point you to the research so you can learn more.
I want to tease one more thing. I read in your book, Chantel, some people, like this is me, have an internal monologue that is words, and some people don't. And yes, I can't comprehend not, and I imagine it's the same going the other way. What's going on with that?
Oh, I'm so glad you said that, because I kept thinking if I was listening to your show, that's what I would call in and say. My husband, I just so happened to have to be married to a person who thinks in what he calls consciousness Netflix on mute. So I have a little bit of insight into this because it boggles the mind. So many people who think in pictures just assume that everybody thinks in pictures. And when they see these internal monologues playing out in movies or stories, they think it's just artistic license for how to explain what's going on in someone's mind. And vice versa, the majority of people, although we don't have good science to actually tell us what proportion, think in a sort of, you know, verbal monologue. I not only do I think this way, I talk to plants and so forth and so on. I'm highly verbal. I'm predisposed to code the world verbally. And what I suspect is happening based on a tidbit of research on the way people represent information is that some of our brains are just set up to distinguish things better visually, and others are just set up to distinguish things better verbally. Now, there are a whole bunch of different environments in which one or the other thing would work better. But if your brain works one way, like I have done tasks where you're supposed to be remembering non-nameable things like a fractal, my brain will still try and name it. I'm like, that's the 7 looking thing. That's the this looking thing. And it does. I do terrible. Like if I would just be quiet and try and look at the thing, I would remember better. But because my brain is set up this way, it tries to organize the world according to semantics and verbal labels. I think it's easier. It must be something about my brain that makes that easier. And so that's the code I use to think to myself.
We'll leave it there. Chantal, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's neuroscientist Chantal Pratt. Her new book is out today. It's called The Neuroscience of You, How Every Brain is Different and How to Understand Yours. Keep sharing your stories. You can email ideas@WPR.org. Coming up after the news, a recent report finds most Wisconsin farm households need a significant source of off-the-farm income to survive. Coming up, we talk about the changing relationship between farmers and small-town economies. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we take a look at what a pandemic spike in violent crime has looked like in rural parts of the country. First, agriculture has been a driver of Wisconsin's economy for a long time, but low commodity prices and ongoing trade disputes in the last several years have put a lot of farmers under pressure, in some cases, out of business. A recent report looks at the latest data to see how farmers are making ends meet. It finds that most Wisconsin farm households need a significant source of off-the-farm income to survive. The author of that report joins us now for a look at what this means for rural economies and the future of farming in Wisconsin. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Are we talking about you? Do you have a farm? Do you or maybe your spouse split time on and off the farm? How important are non-farm sources of income? Maybe a job off the farm? Maybe it's Social Security. Did you leave farming because of some of these pressures? Call it at 800-642-1234. 1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Steve Deller is a UW Extension Community Economic Development Specialist and professor in agricultural and applied economics at UW-Madison. Steve, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me back.
Well, I want to start with a comment on Facebook. David writes, if one isn't a huge farm, it isn't worth it to farm. And that's a good starting point, I think. The size of Wisconsin farms has really diverged in a lot of ways. Can you tell us what's going on?
It really has. There's been a kind of a hollowing out of the middle of the farm distribution. Kind of your typical, stereotypical, you know, average family farm really doesn't exist anymore. And its farms are either moving towards bigger or they're trying to scale back to cut their costs down. And this is a real challenge for us that study agriculture in Wisconsin is when you do a simple head count of the number of farms out there, the vast majority of farms, over 50% of the farms, are really very, very, very small. And we get into a question is, you know, is this really a farm or not?
Yeah, if we have conversations about the average farm in Wisconsin, that's super misleading, right? Because so many of them are moving toward the extremes of big economy of scale or smaller, what do you want to call it, hobby farm or farming plus other stuff?
That's true. And one of the things that has allowed this transition to smaller scale, perhaps to kind of cut some of the costs a little bit, is this notion of off-farm income. And that's why I wanted to kind of look at that particular question.
Right. Now, talk about what you're trying to find out as you looked at the data about where farm households are getting their money.
Well, historically, a lot of farms have, you know, had off-farm income. Somebody in the farm household, generally the spouse, has worked off-farm, but it's historically been to get access to health care. But that's changed over time. What's happening now is that when you look at the farm enterprise versus or opposed to the farm household or the farm family, the farm household has really almost become 100% dependent upon off-farm income. And what we're seeing is that because the farm family is stable, or relatively stable, because of that off-farm income, they're able to keep the farm enterprise up and running.
Talk about the kinds of farming we're talking about here, that commodity farming, those huge fields of, say, corn for animal feed or those really big dairy farms. That's one thing. What are these smaller farms doing?
Well, there's a lot of smaller farms that are getting into more specialized crops. This is partially the local foods movement. It's partially the expansion of interest in more specialized foods. So we're seeing the growth in, say, the number of farmers that are, say, growing hops, or the number of farmers, there was tremendous growth in the number of farmers that were growing cranberries, for example. And we're seeing a more diversified agriculture. I grew up in Illinois, and it was basically corn and beans. And if you had a 2,000-acre farm, you were small. Wisconsin agriculture is very different in that it's very diversified. We're still the cheese state. Dairy still dominates, but we're extremely diversified across a range of different types of commodities and different types of crops.
When we start to look at these smaller farms now in particular, you look at what this off-farm income is. What kind of things are we talking about?
Well, in terms of the level of income, if you're looking at farms that have sales, and this is Wisconsin, if you have farms with sales of more than $1 million, you're looking at about 14% of farm household income coming from off the farm. And that's generally tied to that access to health insurance. But when you get to farms that have less than $100,000 in sales, which is the vast majority of Wisconsin farms, you're looking at 102% of income coming from off-farms. Now, how can it be more than 100%? Well, what that's saying is that this off-farm income is actually supplementing the farm. So it's essentially saying that if we want to keep a lot of these quote-unquote family farms operating, we need to ensure that there's stable sources of off-farm income to keep the farm family stable.
Talking to Steve Deller, UW Extension Community Economic Development Specialist, professor in agricultural and applied economics at UW-Madison, looking at farm income, farm household income. A new study he writes says a lot of Wisconsin farms rely on income coming from off the farm, an outside job, say, or Social Security. You can join in with your questions, maybe your own personal experiences at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Okay, let's talk policy now, Steve. If I want to help rural Wisconsin, the ways I do that are very different if a farm household's making all or most of their income directly from the farm versus a lot of it off the farm. What does that mean for things that can help preserve these farms and boost these rural economies?
One of the challenges that we have is that when you're talking, say, at the state level and definitely at the national level, representatives from urban areas tend to dominate, because that's where most of the population is. So you have folks that are talking about rural development that are coming at it from a very urban perspective. And there's this misnomer that rural America and agriculture are synonymous. In many parts of the U.S., that's true. But there's probably more rural areas where agriculture is one piece of the puzzle. Now, with this particular piece of research, what we're saying is that relationship between the rural community and farming, agriculture, is kind of flipped. So now, rather than those rural communities being dependent upon farming, it's those farms are now dependent on those rural communities.
So what do you do about that? How do you, I mean, it's easy to say we'll subsidize a crop, say, or something like that. Now, if you're flipping it around, what kind of strategies can you use?
Well, the one strategy is, again, to try to help policymakers understand that the nature of rural America and rural Wisconsin is changing. It has changed. And if we want to have a vibrant farming economy, which I think we should, because it's part of our culture, it's part of who we are as a state, we approach it in a different way. We approach it in a sense of looking at employment opportunities off farm. Now, how do we go about promoting economic development in these smaller rural communities? How long have you got? Because we could talk all day on that.
Get started.
The real driver of economic growth, and I'll talk in terms of employment, it's from new business startups. It's from entrepreneurship. And, you know, a lot of the existing businesses, if you look over time and you look at net job growth, existing businesses tend to shed more jobs than they add. So if it wasn't for new job growth or new business formation, entrepreneurship, we would be losing employment left and right historically. This goes back 30 years. Almost every state follows the same pattern. So I think that a lot of what we need to do is start looking at small business development, entrepreneurship, kind of that mom and pop type of business. The one analogy that I use sometimes, it's we have to plant like 100 seeds. And of those 100 seeds, maybe 50 will take root. Of those 50, maybe 20 will actually grow into healthy plants or healthy businesses. Of that 20, maybe 2 will actually become a major employer. We need to kind of nurture those along the way. The problem is that when we plant those 100 seeds, we don't know which 2 are going to become the major employers. So we kind of have to look at a kind of across the board and try to nurture all of these at the same time.
Steve Deller is with us, UW Extension Community Economic Development Specialist, professor in Agricultural and Applied Economics at UW-Madison. Talking with Steve about the ways that farm families earn their incomes on and off the farm a lot, especially for smaller farms, very common in Wisconsin, rely heavily on off-farm income, jobs and otherwise. Look at what that means for rural communities and for boosting the economy of rural Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a farm, new or maybe an old family farm? Do you work off of that farm, or does your spouse? How much do you depend on that income? Are you looking for this kind of off-farm employment? If you're in a rural community, do you have businesses starting up? Are you starting up a business yourself, maybe in a small town? What would help you do that? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can call in now or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up the conversation with Steve Deller, a community economic development specialist for UW Extension, looking at the ways farmers earn their income in Wisconsin, a lot of it coming from off of the farm, one or maybe both members of a farm family relying in large part on jobs outside the farm, and what it all means for developing economies in rural parts of the state. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are we talking about you? Are we talking about your community? How has, if you're in farming or your family has been, how has that changed over the years? What would help your rural community develop itself? What kind of things would help create new businesses there? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Steve, are there ways that a local community or even the state government can give a nudge to help with that sort of startup, that business startup you're talking about? I assume just waiting around and hoping it might not come along.
That doesn't happen. One of the things that we're looking at. A colleague of mine, Tessa Conroy, has been doing a lot of work on this. And you have you ever heard the phrase, it's not what you know, it's who you know?
Mm-hmm.
And that's really true when you're talking about entrepreneurship and small business development. It's that network of people that you know, that network of people that you can tap into, that you can learn from. That is extremely important. Chambers of commerce sometimes do that. Business associations sometimes do that. But one of the things that rural communities kind of struggle with is that this kind of independence is something that's held in high regard. Unfortunately, when you're trying to start a business or you're trying to grow a business, that independence can actually be, it can hold you back. So one of the things that a lot of communities are doing is that they're trying to develop stronger networks, stronger opportunities or better opportunities for potential entrepreneurs and small business owners to get together. They're trying to develop mentorship programs where some of the existing, quote-unquote, successful local business owners can kind of provide mentoring services. These are all really kind of, they're not flashy. They're not shiny. They're not the kinds of things that the media tends to pick up on. So it's really very, it's subtle type of work. But when you talk to economic development practitioners in these rural communities, they get the most professional reward when they're seeing local businesses getting together and sharing ideas and connecting and buying from each other and selling to each other. So that kind of networking can be extremely important.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Nate is with us in Madison. Nate, hi.
Yeah, thanks, guys. Professor, I would like you to comment, perhaps in some depth. We keep hearing about the need for broadband, and I'm travel a lot around the state in sort of some of the more remote areas. And I know that you can't even have a sustained cell conversation in some of the more remote areas of the state. How it seems quite evident to me that if we want to have economic, a robust economic development program, that broadband expansion would be one significant piece mm-hmm. of that puzzle.
Nate, thanks a lot for the call. Rural broadband, Steve.
I think that's extremely important. Broadband, one of the terms that we use is that it's a necessary condition, but it's not sufficient. Building broadband is not a magic bullet, but one thing that we learned from COVID and people kind of, you know, students having to learn from home, people telecommuting, and things like that, is that access to quality, reliable, affordable broadband is extremely important. Now, one of the things that we're looking at right now is the cost of broadband from a consumer's perspective. One of the things that we found when we were looking at Wisconsin broadband a couple of years ago is that there's a real disconnect when it comes to income. Even if broadband is available, oftentimes it's simply too expensive for a lot of households and individuals. And what we're seeing is that it's kind of a further divide in terms of the poverty trap. This is something that we're trying to work on to try to get a better handle on, what does the cost, the subscription cost of broadband, and could there be policies not just to build the infrastructure, but to also make it more affordable for low-income households.
Thanks a lot for that call, Nate. We'll go to Terry now in Lake Geneva. Terry, hi.
Hello.
Hi, go ahead, Terry. You're on the air.
We're probably the smallest cheesemaker in the state of Wisconsin that makes cheese from cow's milk. We milk the cows and we make the cheese. And there's a lot of grant programs that the state and the federal government come up with, but they always talk about how supportive they are of small business. But we recently applied for a grant to get a piece of equipment to allow us to pierce cheese so we could make blue cheese. which would expand our product line. We didn't get a grant, but Tolls got a grant. Tolls is a company that does in excess of $100 million a year, and they gave them a small business grant.
When you talk to the Small Business Administration, they define any business with less than 500 employees as small. Mm-hmm. I think when you're talking about rural Wisconsin, that's a big employer. So there's a matter of definition here. I think this goes back to that notion about networking, because when you apply for these grants, there's a lot of paperwork involved. And this is something that's always kind of a yin and yang with federal grants and state grants and whatnot, is that the amount of paperwork can be really burdensome. But this is taxpayers' money. We really kind of have to make sure that we cross all the T's and dot all the I's, because this is taxpayers' money. So there's kind of a give and take there. But one of the things that some of our extension educators are working on is trying to provide a network of expertise, if you will, for folks to kind of fill out and apply for these grants, because there's a trick to it. And once you learn that trick, you can be pretty successful. I think the other thing that you mentioned is that the big firms getting it. It goes back to my comment about, you know, a lot of the stuff that rural communities are doing is not very flashy, not very shiny. Sometimes there's a political motivation to go after these big projects because they're shiny. They get media coverage. And that's something that it's a challenge.
Thanks a lot for that call, Terry. Terry is in the food processing business as well as doing dairy himself. I believe you've told me in the past, Steve, we employ more people in food processing than in agriculture itself. Do you see still the room for growth? Could these be the kinds of businesses we're talking about in these communities, these startups?
That was actually, you're right. I mean, when you look at food processing employs more people and generates more of the economic impact than on-farm. But we could get into this kind of chicken and egg type of discussion. But the other thing is that a lot of the food processing is in urban areas. So when you think about agriculture, including on-farm and food processing, it's agriculture is an urban phenomenon. But folks don't one of the things, though, I think that's really important here is that with a lot of these smaller farms and the movement towards more local foods, I use that term very generically, is this notion of value added. Of actually taking your product and trying to add some value to it and capturing some of that money. A number of local businesses, local farmers, are trying to move in that direction. So we're almost seeing agriculture, again, bifurcate into large commodity. They're selling into the commodity market, yellow cheese number two, or they're moving into these product markets where you can actually kind of market it and try to make a little bit of money off of that. Now, that's a form of entrepreneurship, and how can we help nurture that?
Right, and briefly, if I'm barely making ends meet with my farm, can I afford, say, the equipment to do that value added?
No, that's where off-farm income comes into play, because what off-farm income does is that it stabilizes the farm family, the farm household, and allows the farm to maybe take a few risks that normally it wouldn't do, because the family is stable.
Steve, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Steve Deller, Community Economic Development Specialist and Professor in Agricultural and Applied Economics at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. We talked with Steve about farm households in Wisconsin and the importance of off-farm sources of income. Very important, especially to the many smaller farms in the state, and what it all means for development, economic development in rural parts of the state. Still time for you to share your story, by the way. You can do that over on the Ideas Network Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Coming up after the news, there is an increase in violent crime in the U.S. starting in 2020. Cities get a lot of the attention, but rural areas have also seen a significant increase. We'll find out what's driving that trend. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.